Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
On the 19th of May, 1804, Napoleon Bonaparte elevated 18 of France's most capable commanders to a new tier of acclaim in the French military system, the title of Marshal of France. It was an honor that would be bestowed on a total of 26 individuals in Napoleon's reign. But for as long as there have been marshals, there has been a lingering question. Who was the greatest, the bravest, the most competent, the most reliable, the most dedicated, the most integral to the success of Napoleonic France? It's a question that has taxed the minds of fans of the period for 200 years and will do for 200 more. And now it has come to our door. Tonight, on the 220th anniversary of the creation of the Marshalet, and to mark the 200th installment of the Napoleonic Wars pod, a titanic clash is underway as we witness the opening salvo of the Battle of the Marshals. In this, the first of five heats, bravest of the brave Michel Ney faces off against the indispensable Louis-Alexandre Berthier and the man who made Wellington worry, Nicolas Jean de Dieu Soult. And in homage to what this show has always done best, it is the members of the Napoleonic Wars pod community who are taking centre stage to fly the flag for their favourite marshals. Ed Coss fights for Berthier, Todd Campbell charges to the defence of Ney, whilst Dan Hazelwood rallies the troops in favour of Soult. Heavyweights and fan favourites must fall, as only one can make it through to the semi-final in their quest for the crown that so many of these, France's most acclaimed soldiers, would have desperately and jealously vied for, the title of Napoleon's greatest marshal. Who wins? You decide. The Battle of the Marshals, Berthier, Ney and Soult, is up next on the Napoleonic Wars pod.
Hello and welcome to the Napoleonic Wars pod, where, as you have heard, it is round one of the Battle of the Marshals. Berthier, Ney and Soult, three heavyweights going head to head in a do or die dash for the ultimate glory of winning heat one of the Napoleonic Wars pod contest of who's the greatest marshal. It's a great glittering prize that, let's be honest, is all that the ghosts of these marshals could possibly hope to aspire to in life. Joining me over the course of this, I'd say it'll be torturous. For me, it won't be torturous, but for you guys who've got to listen to it, we haven't got to listen to it, but let's be honest, you'll be listening to it. Listening to this torturous extravaganza, I am joined throughout by the redoubtable Sam Jolly, curator. Oh, you're going to say hi straight off the bat. Curator of the Royal Logistic Corps Museum, at Worthy Down near Winchester, formerly assistant curator of the Royal Engineers Museum as well. I often refer to her as one of the few Bonapartists who can actually manage to be charming, which is a unique accolade because some of my interactions with Bonapartists are not what you would describe as festive in their nature. Sam, I gather that you were sulking ever so slightly when you discovered that having just donated blood, I might then force you to not eat your lovely pastry that you bought on the way home until I relented. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. Cameras on. I originally assumed meant no massive apple and cinnamon massive pastry, but you can all just watch me eat and I'll try not to chomp too much into the camera.
That would be helpful, she says, promptly chomping too much into the camera. Equally joining us is the estimable Josh Proven, master of adventures in Historyland YouTube channel, author of Bullock's Grain and Good Madeira and Every Hazard and Fatigue, the book that you require. Josh just attempted to show you what the cover looked like, but unfortunately he stuck a greyed out filter on his background, so you can't actually see the book. Oh, we do now have a better look at it. It's on the Siege of Pensacola, folks. If you didn't hear the episode, go back and have a listen to the episode, available at Hellion. Go support. Josh's a fantastic guy, does a lot of these podcasts. The least you can do is help him by purchasing what is going to be a very good book. I regret to say I have not had the opportunity to read it, Josh. Please accept my apologies. I will get to it, but it's somewhere on that massive pile that hides behind the camera in order to try and make my life not look too chaotic. But welcome, both of you. So we're going to open not by diving straight into the marshals, but we're going to play a festive game of guess your favourite marshal. I'm sure you've played this at home, folks. So if you're not familiar with the rules, then where have you been with all of your life? Now, admittedly, I have the advantage over Sam on this because I know who her favourite marshal is. So I'm going to have to leave the... Oh, actually, Josh, did I tell you who Sam's favourite marshal is before we started coming on air? Sam looks peeved. For those of you who aren't watching this on YouTube, you're listening to the audio version. Firstly, there is a YouTube stream of each of these episodes with some of the people pitching for different marshals appearing actually on camera. Lovely touch. But yeah, Sam looks rather peeved at the fact that I have spoilt her entry into the party. So we will have to go for your second favourite.
I do think actually that Sam might have told me, or someone might have told me before anyway, during the whole mocking Napoleon sequence of events over the past month about...
The entirety of Twitter by now, and I assume my marshal is. I'm not exactly subtle.
this is true. So for those who don't already know, Sam has a pre-declared, thoroughly conscious bias towards Lan, which I can empathise with. Take the best bits of Mura and Davu, and maybe Saul. We'll get to that. That's a whole other discussion. Josh looks like he's having his teeth pulled as I make these suggestions. But I like Lan. I can see why somebody would go for Lan. But your second favourite marshal, I do not know. I'm not even sure.
Do you have a second favourite marshal?
That's exactly where I was going with it.
I didn't realise I had a second favourite marshal until the last 10 seconds when I panicked and went, who is it? And then a name instantly came to mind. So how do we do this?
I'm going to be frank and just shout it. It's going to be Mura, isn't it?
No. Now, I can see why you said that, because in a previous episode of your podcast, I have very delightedly shouted, Mura! But no.
Yeah, you are going to have to explain that context for people who think you've now lost your mind.
I was very, very upset that in the recent Ridley Scott Napoleon movie that there was a very big absence of marshals. And I felt that it was probably because they couldn't afford in the Hairspray budget someone to play Mura. And then it wouldn't be fair on everyone else to have this splendid looking man just prancing around going, Mura, do-do-do-do. So that's now the Mura jingle.
The other thing about Mura is that you need somebody with an impressive thigh game and preferably a good buttock game as well. And it's very hard to find a Hollywood actor who
Henry
can
Cavill.
Pull off both. So we know your interests there. No prizes for guessing what you've been watching.
She's a fan of the cavalry in its entirety, then.
So it would seem. So that's Sam's... my attempt to guess Sam's second favourite marshal is a failure, which means the pressure is now squarely on Josh.
I'd have to just completely guess out of the blue, to be honest, because I don't know the criteria for why you like Lan. But...
oh, we're going to insert a new rule. You can ask one question.
Oh, okay. Why do you like... why do you like Lan?
Oh, no. I didn't come here to justify myself. I came to judge other people's justifications. I like Lan because I'm very shallow and he is very pretty. And he has very lovely hair in all of his paintings, but also he is very brave, whilst also coupling it with being a great tactician, whilst also coupling it with caring about his soldiers and being very well loved by his soldiers. One of my favourite battles is also the Battle of Arkla, and he pretty much like smashed himself there. He was like, yeah, straight in there. So that's a very badly articulated version of why I like Lan.
No.
You managed to salvage it, though, because you increased the depth of your reasoning for liking Lan as you went along. It was like you kind of realised that just going, he looked pretty, probably wasn't going to cut muster on this podcast, because I do have a reputation for being savage when it comes to questioning.
Putting women in history back by miles with that.
You salvaged it.
It's only fair.
Okay, so out with that, Josh. What say ye?
Well, unfortunately, you covered too broad a spectrum now again, because first of all, like, yes, he's a good looking guy. All right. Maybe it's one of the, you know, better, more aesthetic marshals. But then you were like, oh, he's also good as well. So that's a problem as, in itself. Maybe I have to go with I would have to guess. I'm going to get two names pop up. One is probably incorrect because it's too on the nose, and it's Davout, because everybody apparently loves Davout, or Bessier possibly.
I do love Davout. Bessier's I have some beef with, which we'll come up with in the best.
We'll look forward to that. But
you are completely incorrect.
Okay, well, you've got a seeing as Josh had two goes, I'm gonna have two goes. I'm looking through the list, trying to work it out. Are you going for Ney?
Yes.
There we go.
Which means I have a bias in this episode as well.
Right.
Almost said Ney. No, too much like Lan.
is that even possible? Okay. So that's Sam's bias declared. We'll save least favorite marshal for an intro in another episode. But let's go now to Josh. Josh's favorite marshal. You've already given the hint that it's not going to be Davout because you were so scathing there.
Given my reputation on every podcast I've ever done, on this podcast indeed, for whatever topic that I have to choose to fight for, why would you think it's one of the ones?
Yeah, I mean, this is the point. It's not going to be an obvious one, is it? Because it's you, Josh. It's going to be somebody who I haven't even thought about. And I think you're going to go quite left field. So I'm torn between somebody like Jourdan and MacDonald. I don't think you'd go for Grouchy because... I think you'd... I'm just giving Sam ammunition here, aren't I?
Talking it through. She's just lapping it up.
It could be Marmont. It could be Marmont. Oh, that complicates things.
Watching the thought processes go through is fascinating.
This is why, folks, you need to head over to the YouTube channel so you can watch my torture. God knows what the runtime's going to be on this episode, because we're already like 10 minutes in, 50 minutes in, and we haven't even touched on the pictures themselves. You wouldn't go for Messina. No, you wouldn't go for Messina. Jourdan. I don't think it's right, but I'm going to say Jourdan.
That is a very, very good guess. It's not quite correct, though. Okay. I have a lot of time for Jourdan, but it's not him.
Okay, Sam, over to you.
So my question is, was he
Oh, you can ask questions. I forgot my own rules.
this rule?
I'm making this up as I go along. Have you not listened to this podcast before?
And so the chaos ensues. My question is, was he a turncoat bastard after 1815?
After 1815. So what, in
Absolutely.
1816?
Okay, well, was he a turncoat bastard who served the nefarious Bourbons?
No. Not technically, no.
Oh.
You have to bear with me here. There's actually quite a lot of turncoats who served the Bourbons after a certain point, okay? I'm trying not to mislead you. I would not qualify him in those ter as a turncoat to the for the Bourbons.
Oh, so oh, does that mean that he served them?
No. You've had one question. You can't have a
Okay.
second. Now that I've remembered this rule, I'm going to stick to it. I think I've worked out who it might be. Unless I've misremembered something, but I think I've got my second guess now. But remember, Sam, you do get two guesses.
Yeah, well, I'm now wondering. So it wasn't, mine was more of a rhetorical question where I was thinking out loud. So listeners need my thought processes, but it's okay, Captain Fun Sponge. You can put me down. I was gonna say, does that mean that he served the Bourbons in
Can I just say it's Dr. Fun Sponge if you're sticking to the lore on this, which is a whole other thing that we haven't got time to explain. Alex Churchill has answers for you if you have questions on this.
So for the third time, before I interrupted again, I was musing that maybe that meant that he served the Bourbons in like during the time during Napoleon's time in Elba, which means that I'd then go with maybe nay, because he served
Ah.
them for a little bit, but he
You
didn't
see,
end
this is the
up there.
thing. Yeah. Right.
That's my
Well,
logic.
that's good logic because it's they did turn coat, didn't he?
Then he didn't, so all is well.
Right,
I'm
right.
glad I finally got my musings out. Thank you, dear men, for giving me the opportunity to speak. I will now be silent for the rest of the episode as per the women quota.
As is
You are very welcome.
as is right and proper.
It is our benevolence to allow you to make an utterance,
What
but you
was
have
your
now
so
used up your time.
your guess was nay. Your guess was nay, though,
My guess
yes?
was nay, yeah.
Nay. Alas, no. Alas, no. It's two on the nose.
McDonald, that's my second guess.
Alas, no. That's no
Ah.
applause.
Sam, you are permitted to speak.
Thank you, O gracious one. Oh, am I allowed to ask another question, or is it literally just two?
No,
Oh,
no.
okay. Well, I think that you quite like admin wizards. I think you're a bit of a stickler for the paperwork. So it's not a question, that's a statement. So I'm going to go with, oh God, has Zach, this proves that I haven't listened to anything Zach said.
There's nothing new there then.
I don't know whether he's already said this. Is it Bertier?
This is a very, very, very fascinating thing. I asked Zach earlier, you probably heard it, whether I'm allowed to give the answer that, like, give my favorite marshal, like, what was it before that I listened to all the pitches, and what was it, what it is now. I've been told I have to give the answer of what it was. And under the criteria, indeed, of what we're going to do, actually, it still probably remains. But alas, no, it is not Bertier. But actually,
Surely it's not Bernadotte. That's not me bending the rules and having a third guess, but
there are no rules anymore.
there is
there never were any
nothing.
rules. Who are we kidding?
Let's tear it all down. No. Right. Excellent guesses. You're very, very close on two of them. Jourdan and Berthier would actually be quite close to my favorite marshal. Mostly for the jokes, it is Bernadotte.
Okay, interesting. Okay, now
That's,
it's.
however, that is before this episode came about, and I thought about it a little. But
That's
it's Bernadotte,
interesting.
the Bernadotte, arguably the most successful of Napoleon's marshals.
Indeed, indeed. Okay. Do you want to try and guess mine? Or shall we save that for another episode?
I mean, you're the boss.
Let's save it for another episode. Let's keep people on tenterhooks, make them want to come back for round two. Who was Zach's favorite marshal? Because that's the really important question.
We'll try and like get as much information as we can through this episode.
Yeah, good luck. Good luck. So there you go, folks. There's something to look forward to because that's exactly what you came here for. No, but seriously, we're going to finally attempt to be sensible. We won't succeed in being sensible, but we'll attempt to be sensible. And we shall dive straight in. The rules of this engagement are not particularly simple. We have lost a few along the way. You will have heard that in the introduction. Unfortunately, some people weren't able to provide pitches for personal reasons. All the very best to them and much love to their families. It does therefore mean that in this heat, we only have three contenders, which is frankly just as well, because what contenders they are. Berthier, described by Ed Koss as a marshal like no other, arguably Napoleon's right hand sphere of his brain as much as his right hand, full stop. Ney, of course, the bravest of the brave, the fiery, fiery marshal. Do you know who I am? I am Ney. As you will hear the person pitching for Ney shout in due course. And of course, Soult, one of the few people to really come dangerously close to breaking Wellington, as Wellington himself, I think, would happily confess. So three heavyweights, all worthy of making the final, frankly, in their own right. But they're not going to make the final, not all of them, because the way this will work, we have split the group of marshals into five separate heats in which they will wage a duel, a gladiatorial contest in order to basically come out on top. It's really that simple. The judges are going to listen to all of the pitches. We'll then have a quick discussion off the back of them, and the judges will rank those pitches, awarding 5 points, because I know the rules. 5 points to their favorite, four to their second favorite, and so on down the list. Then we pass it over to a public vote. This is not quite simply a sort of rigged Napoleon-style autocratic sham election. Sam actually looks more peeved at the lack of electoral fraud rather than the fact that I've just taken a dig against her favourite figure from history. But we will open this up to a public vote. So, folks, if you're listening to this on Spotify, you will see that there are questions down below. There will be the option for you to vote within that. I'll set it up so that it works, promise. If you're watching on YouTube, comment is probably the simplest thing, and then I'll just scroll through the comments and count each comment as a vote in favor. Simple. But if you head over to Twitter, there will also be a Twitter poll for you to engage in. So one way or another, you will be able to have your say. Now, if you're inclined towards electoral fraud, you will realize that you could, of course, vote in all three capacities and therefore skew the system. I definitely wouldn't advocate that you do that for your favorite. No, definitely not. I will then put the results of the two together, and the person who comes out on top will, of course, go through to the second round. Yes, there are three rounds, people. The second round will be a balloon debate where not one, not two, not three, nor four, nor five, nor six, but seven marshals will slug it out in a balloon debate where we will basically jettison the ballast of the remaining marshals who have won their heats, and chuck them over the side of the balloon, and be very harsh and draconian and uncaring as they wail their way down to the ground below. At the end of that process, two will remain who will then slug it out in a titanic duel for the title of greatest marshal, as pronounced by the Napoleonic Wars pod, because let's be honest, that's what matters. We're going to dive straight into it at this point with the first pitch. As you're listening along at home, please do comment. What are you liking about the pitches? What are you perhaps less keen about? Do you agree with some of the points? Inevitably, you will find that the people pitching, who are drawn from fans of this show, so this is a lovely little kind of element. I feel that it's their chance to get involved. So be nice, people. Don't be an ass. What are you convinced by, but also what you're not convinced by? Are you
having your perception changed as a result of these pitches. Think as much about the arguments as just your favorite. Don't just go, well, I like nay, so therefore I'm going to shout nay endlessly into the microphone, looking at nobody in particular within the context of this room. First up, we have perhaps the most obvious place to start, Berthier. As I've said already, the right sphere of Napoleon's brain. Berthier has been championed by Ed Koss, as you will now hear, and he's decided to approach this one rather uniquely by doing it in the first person.
Historian Charles Robert later described me, Louis-Alexander Berthier, as, quote, the ever-hardworking organizer managing the less glorious task of keeping the army fit for the fight under heavily unfavorable conditions. From 1804 on, I was the senior of all Napoleon's marshals, answerable only to him. I translated Napoleon's almost indecipherable writing and transcribed his often harsh and always lightning-paced dictation into orders that made Napoleon's ideas into a reality. Everything, information on intel, logistics, troop readiness, troop dispositions, topography, enemy strength, locations, etc., were compiled by me and passed to Napoleon. His related orders were then assembled and passed on to commands by yours truly. One only needs to see my carriage now displayed at the Musée d'Armée in Paris to realize the depth and breadth of my contributions. My coach, with all its slide drawers and compartments, held all the paperwork that managed the mechanisms controlling French armies in multiple lands. This carriage and I acted as a 19th century computer, putting the systems for command and control in Napoleon's disposal. No army then or today can survive significant organizational and logistical missteps. I was charged with and successfully completed administrative tasks that would now take up many senior planning staffs. As John Elting later noted, I was charged with, quote, all the problems connected with the needs of the army and its transport. All were thrown at him. He was always the clearinghouse to which all business was transacted, the infallible day book to which Napoleon was referring every minute of every day. I'm usually considered to be courageous. Consider my actions at the bridge at Lodi before you deride me as being just a pencil pusher. I was good-natured, self-disciplined, and a true workaholic. I almost never badmouthed Napoleon, even after I received an undeserved tongue-lashing by my volatile master. No lesser authority than this British academic named David Chandler waxed poetic on my unmatched value. Quote, Berthier's capacity for assembling detail and his ability to work 20 hours a day were phenomenal. Bonaparte owed much of his success to the administrative talents of Berthier, his eminence grise. I managed the Army of the Reserve's successful crossing of the Alps for First Consul Bonaparte in 1804, a nightmarish task that set the stage for his career. I then helped direct Napoleon's armies through campaigns in a dozen countries for well more than a decade that followed Napoleon's foray over the Alps. No small thing that I saw and I managed it all. One need only consider the period of nearly endless warfare from 1804 to Waterloo to marvel at the vast numbers of administrative decisions on which Napoleon and I collaborated. The incomprehensible numbers of these organizational exchanges were the genesis of Napoleon's strategic, operational, and tactical decision-making. I am most proud of that. I made a difference, a big difference, Napoleon's armies. Sadly, just before the Waterloo campaign, I was helped out of a third-story window by a Frenchman and his Prussian cousin while in Bamberg. These two scoundrels thought that my death might derail Napoleon's return from Elba in 1815 and the wars that were likely to follow. They thought I was that important. I fell like a stone, by the way. Unfortunately, so did Napoleon at Waterloo. I likely would have made a difference. Not to be immodest, but I was always at the center of everything. Other marshals made a real difference in the outcomes of battles. Some even affected campaigns. I respected them for their sacrifices and deeds. No marshal other than me, however, influenced nearly every aspect of Napoleon's operations. Thus, of all the marshals, I had the most profound impact on his campaigns. Napoleon once said of me, quote, "No one could replace him," end quote. Not to be self-aggrandizing, but I was a marshal like no other.
Ed Koss there making the case for Berthier, as he says, a marshal like no other, and a novel approach. Kudos there for making us think a little bit differently, doing it from Berthier's perspective. Also noting that Ed spurned the opportunity to sling dirt, which for the most part the other competitors did. They were given a very strict time limit, 7.5 minutes, but they were allowed some additional time to critique the other marshals, but declined to do so. And generally speaking, that's been the case, apart from some unfavourable comparisons being made in a couple of the pitches. So, Napoleon's right arm, half of his brain, is that fair? I mean, the obvious one is Waterloo as the evidence for that. Without Berthier, what happens to Napoleon? But you could also make the case that actually there's a reason that he abdicates for the first time, and Berthier is there to assist during the downfall years, the decline. I guess the big question for me is about his battle record by comparison with the other marshals. Ed referenced Lodi, fair, but I wonder if that's perhaps the chink in Berthier's armor. He isn't known for any one particular engagement that we can use to point to his skills beyond his administrative ones.
No, this is true. It's always going to be Berthier's problem, Louis Alexandre, good old Louis. The problem I have with judging the marshals, and this sounds a little strange, solely on their battle record or the opposite, is that some of them did their best work before the Empire started. That's even some of the better battlefield commanders. By the time the Napoleonic Wars start, they fade into the distance and a sort of a younger bunch show up. The ones who fought in the Republic arguably could be compared with the more famous Napoleonic marshals as greater. And we'll see that sort of comparison going on. So I don't think we should hold that against Berthier. So that's not a problem for me.
Is it a problem for Sam, though? That's the million-dollar question.
I come to this chat with so many biases. My favorite campaign ever of any war, of any people, is the first Italian campaign. So to me, his finest military era being that first Italian campaign is just a plus to me. But compared, I guess it depends what the criteria here is for being the best marshal, because if the criteria for being the best marshal is having the best military campaigns, like actively on campaign, then he's not going to stand that. But if it's being the best admin wizard, ball's open, court's like, open.
Like Ed says, I thought I took Ed's point or general point quite well. I think that Berthier is a special case in a strange sort of way, because he does so much of his work, especially when the Empire starts, the Marchionette begins, as chief of staff. And there's an argument to be made that the others don't get to fight if he doesn't do what he does. So.
He's the great facilitator, isn't he? And this is the challenge that what happens if with the best one in the world, you could take Lan out of history and
As
history would be very different.
indeed happened.
Well, indeed. That was brutal. That was very much a low blow there, Josh.
What, Brian?
I'm sorry, did Aspen Estley not happen? It's like
Well, yes, but back to my original point. Which is that if you take Lan out or if you take Mura out, you take a lot of these guys out, history is very different. And that's not to suggest that they're not key in Bonaparte's success. Take Davout out and what happens in the twin battles of Jena Auerstedt, or what happens at Austerlitz. Each of these guys has really significant roles to play in the course of Napoleonic history, no question. If you take Berthier out, though, actually does much of Napoleonic history happen in quite the same way? I think the Bonapartist regime, the empire, can survive if you take out most of the other marshals. If you take out Berthier, I'm not so sure it does, as we see in 1815. I'm getting quiet and reflective nods. I was expecting sort of angry rebuttals from
No,
our guests.
I mean it's true. Realistically, it's a good argument to make. I mean, there are certain marshals who, at certain battles, do certain things that ensure the continuation of Napoleon's success. Berthier does this every 10 minutes on every day of every campaign. He gets the troops to where they need to go. He gets the messages out. These sorts of things are how wars are conducted. The battles themselves are the result of a lot more hours. So I have you, it's Berthier is very, very difficult to beat as greatest marshal. In a di If you look at the marshals in a different way, as not just soldiers but also administrative figures as well, as they had to be.
Sam, anything you want to say either in defense or in denigration of Berthier?
I mean, my other bias is that logistics win wars, and that logistics might not be sexy, but it is the most important thing. So therefore, it means that I should probably support this argument that he is that his administrative skills make him irreplaceable. But then I also wonder, does that make him irreplaceable? Was there not just other administrative military people behind him that could have been him instead of him?
Which is a good
It's a
question that I can't actually answer. The other point that Ed made was about innovation, and I think that's an important potential yardstick. Not many of these guys actually have the opportunity to be innovative by the nature of their role, but Berthier does, and he embraces it. And I think it's fair to say that what he does as chief of staff goes on to have significant implications for the rest of to this day in terms of military history. Berthier is an example of how to do the job that then gets emulated and sure adapted over the passage of time. Not to say that he did it faultlessly, but that innovation does set him on a different plane to a lot of the others. But then again, we come back to this thing of actually, is Berthier the special case? Does Berthier sit in a plane above his own? Or is that, in fact, the point that Berthier does therefore become the greatest marshal because he's doing things that nobody else did?
When I did when I ranked the Russian generals of 1812 with Jimmy Chen on my channel, we used the tier maker, and he did a lot of the legwork on that. I just sort of facilitated him talking about Russian generals, but we all agreed that there was going to be a god tier, and that was reserved for a general who was dead at the time, Alexander Suvorov, because he was a sort of this encompassing figure that was the greatest Russian general of his age and the age that followed him. So there's a case possibly for a sort of a God tier Berthier kind of thing here.
I mean, there is the case to actually be made, you know, is Berthier on a par with Napoleon? Yes, I just went and said that for many people to instantly get very angry in the comments. You can't compare Berthier to Napoleon. Well, I just did. But you're talking about God tiers. Inevitably, Napoleon sits in a tier of his own. Of course he does.
He's not here. He's not a marshal. He's the
he's
boss.
Not. He is the marshal of marshals.
Yes.
Because they are so integral, you could make the case, could you not, that actually Napoleon and Berthier sit in that tier of their own?
Yeah, I think that I personally think that it's not a question of sort of could one do the other's job. I don't think the other one could do the other's job. Berthier didn't have the personality of Napoleon to do what Napoleon did, but Napoleon didn't have the brain of Berthier to do what Berthier did. So as all generals, they're chiefs of staff. They're kind of the one and the same. And that even goes for Wellington, actually, and Murray.
Okie doke. If we've got nothing else on Berthier, we will move on to the next contender. Todd Campbell picks up this one, talking about Ney, the bravest of the brave.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Stand with me. Are you France? Stand with me. Are you the guard? One more hour and we have Wellington beaten. Don't you know me?
Yes, that's right.
I'm carrying the standard from Michel Ney, Prince of Moscow, the Duke of Elchigan, who undoubtedly is the greatest marshal of the First Empire. Was he loyal? 100% to France. Remember, the question was, who was the greatest marshal of France? Not necessarily to Napoleon. Even historians like Charles Estelle would argue that the Napoleonic era was much bigger than just one man, and indeed it was. Was Ney all balls, no brains? Not by a long shot. He was anything but Marat. To describe Ney's mercurial manner as a negative disposition demonstrates a fundamental lack of understanding of what it took to successfully lead a corps with effective cavalry units during the Napoleonic Wars. A major advantage of possessing cavalry was to keep the opposing army intimidated and second-guessing their formations and movements. Hence, Ney couldn't be predictable. He often had to lead by instinct, as did most legendary commanders of cavalry of his day. Just because he miscalculated the enemy from time to time doesn't wash away his brilliance at other critical battles that include Mannheim, Hohenlohe, Echelingen, Eylau, Borodino, to name a few. So let's break things down so that we all have a balanced and clear understanding as to why Ney was the greatest marshal, not just for the First Empire, but for France itself. Loyalty. Ney was loyal to France, and I would say this alone places him head and shoulders above his peers. To put it another way, Ney was no turncoat like Bernadotte. We often hear criticisms of Napoleon for being heartless over the human cost of war, but not Ney. Ney was deeply connected with his men, and his men adored Ney in return. So much so that he was viewed as the army's talisman. When Napoleon fled to Paris while the remnants of the Grande Armée exited Moscow, Ney formed a rear guard with Third Corps and stood with his men even when their ranks dwindled to just 800 souls. a brilliant tactician and leader, and they exemplified loyalty, character, commitment, bravery, and integrity. Qualities that any soldier would want in their commander. Ney devoutly stood by France, even if he had to drum up the courage to directly confront the emperor to abdicate for the good of the country. Ney naturally reversed his support back to Napoleon a year later when the French army overwhelmingly embraced the emperor's return. Ney, unlike most marshals who blindly followed Napoleon like De Vaux, demonstrated a thoughtful allegiance to France, not to Napoleon, even when that loyalty impacted his own personal situation. Ney simply refused to watch the men that had followed him since the revolution march off to Waterloo without being under his care. All balls, no brains. Marat is often assigned with such a distinction, and it would be well-deserved based on Marat's flamboyance and short-sighted actions and judgment. But most scholars openly admit that there is a strong difference when it comes to Ney, a tested marshal of honor. In fact, Ney was certainly a combination of bravery and intellect. Sure, his opinions may have rubbed his peers the wrong way from time to time, but I would almost wager that General Patton thought of Ney when Patton said, "If everyone is thinking alike, someone isn't thinking." Ney was a thinker. On bravery, Napoleon would say, Ney was priceless for his valor, his obstinacy, and retreats. What a soldier. The army is full of brave men, but Michel Ney is truly the bravest of the brave. Quite an accolade by the emperor, who would later and unconvincingly attempt to lay his defeat at Waterloo at Ney's and Grouchy's feet. But don't just take Napoleon's word for it. His soldiers affectionately called him l'infatigable, the tireless, or le rugueux, the redhead. The colonel under the marshal's command in Russia added, "I can still see him at the spot where the fighting was hottest, speaking to the men, indicating to the generals what positions they should take up, animating all hearts with confidence that flashed in his glances. He made an effect on me I don't know how to describe," end quote. From humble beginnings, being raised by a barrel cooper, to untold glory in French military history. From the French Revolution, the Hundred Days Campaign, Marshal Ney fought throughout the Napoleonic Wars for France and her people. If there was ever a marshal to celebrate, it would be Michel Ney, the bravest man on the battlefield, a soldier who loved France so much that he demanded that he be called a Frenchman at his own peril. I will end on this note. After the emperor was exiled for a second time, Ney was arrested on the 3rd of August in 1815 and tried for treason. His lawyer said that Ney was a Prussian, could not be tried for treason in a French court, as his hometown had been annexed by Prussia. But Ney interrupted his lawyer by saying, "I am a Frenchman, and I will remain a Frenchman." When he was condemned to die by a tribunal of his peers, he was taken by the guardsmen to the Luxembourg Gardens. There he would be executed by a firing squad. Facing his executioners, he said, "Soldiers, when I give you the command, fire and aim straight for my heart. Wait for the order. It will be my last to you. I have fought. I protest against my condemnation. I have fought 100 battles for France and not one against her. Soldiers, fire." And with that, greatest marshal to don the French uniform instantly killed. He was 46 years old.
Todd Campbell there making the case for Ney, looking resplendent in that hat. Apologies if you couldn't quite make it out through the filter that Todd had on when he recorded it. Firstly, we have to congratulate Todd on the costume and the Marshal's baton. I'm not sure we can award any marks for that, but he embraced his inner Mura over the course of that one, though I am mightily relieved that he didn't feel the need to show us his thighs. No offence, Todd, I'm sure you have delightful thighs. I just don't want to see them. He also criticised Mura, which caught me off guard. Well, Josh shakes his head. Josh, are you miffed at me critiquing one of my fans' thighs? Is this not the caliber, or you just think I'm being peevish and unkind?
Zach, it's your show. You can compliment as many of your friends' thighs as you want. This is not my place. I'm just here for the ride.
This is rapidly turning into a very different kind of show, isn't it?
We're now rating thighs.
It wasn't what you expected in the Battle of the Marshals, let's be honest. You clearly didn't read the footnote, mate. Criticised Mura, which caught me off guard. Because
I enjoyed that shade. Oh, I loved that he was throwing shade about.
Yeah, but Todd likes Mura, so that was surprising. I wonder if he was trying to ingratiate himself with me on that one, because he knows me well enough to know that that would go down well.
You can throw shade at people you like. I do it to your face all the time.
You do, but the difference is that you don't actually like me, so it doesn't quite work, that analogy, Sam. Some important points were made there. Connection with his men, something that you can't really talk about particularly in relation to Berthier, partly because Berthier's in a different role, so he doesn't have quite that same need to develop those relationships. Integrity, quite obviously. The thing that I perhaps didn't entirely agree with is that Todd started talking about Ney considering his position. Ney could consider his position without question, but sometimes didn't. Classic case in point would, of course, be the Koa, the action where he manages to snatch a defeat from the jaws of victory by pushing over that bridge, over the River Koa, completely pointlessly and futilely, you know, after it was thoroughly apparent that the Allies had reconsolidated their position on the far side and therefore weren't going to be broken by some do-or-die charge across a bridge that is a few feet wide, quite frankly. It's incredibly narrow. It is the perfect bottleneck. And having inflicted significant losses, then goes and incurs far more losses through this frontal assault at a point where it was meaningless and achieved nothing. So one slight pushback from me there in relation to what Todd said. Ney has an iconic status, hugely popular, of course. That title, The Bravest of the Brave, does mean that he's going to be going toe-to-toe with Berthier and with Soult. So it's going to be a close-run contest on this. But is the Bravest of the Brave thing overdone, would be my one question. Josh, I'm sort of looking at you on this, because we have discussed this point slightly in the past.
Yes, we have. And I have thoughts about Ney. Generally speaking, he's... First of all, the argument is very strong. I think the case is just a little less strong. And whereas with Todd's, both case and argument were very strong. In terms of what I know about Ney, he's not one of the marshals that gets entrusted with independent commands, particularly. He's a rearguard. He's good at rearguards. He proves that in Portugal. And he proves that in Russia, but only after Krasny, where he gets the entire corps destroyed by General Miloradovich instead of surrendering, which is perhaps would have been his ultimate shame had he done so, but he would have saved a lot more men had he just surrendered. Fair cop, you got me. Done. You can't argue that he is not beloved by the soldiers. He's used by Napoleon for that reason in 1815. But he's sort of one of these people that is a marshal, but he's also sort of like a divisional commander. And so he's not, in my estimation, in reputation, he's very high up, possibly because he's in the movies a lot as well. And he has that epithet of bravest of the brave. And after Krasny and he gets back to the army, everybody's like, well, you should be dead. I mean, it's your fault that you should be dead, but you should be dead. and so he just has this he has this sort of cavalier. He's a cavalryman, but he's not a cavalryman. He has a cavalryman's reputation. He gets a lot of stick for Waterloo. Not really his fault. I'm mixed on Ney. I don't mean to be too harsh on him or anything like this, but I don't think he is actually as highly placed as the greatest marshal as his reputation suggests.
Okay, so a hard task to try and convince Josh on this one. The one thing I will say in defense of Ney is don't judge him by Catra Bra. He does all the right things. He's not given the right tools.
He's a very good
you
tactician.
Are judging him by Catra Bra.
He's a good tactician. He's a good tactician. You can't stand in the face of Wellington and Wellington have superior numbers. As good as you did at the beginning of the day and not be good at what you do. It's not, but I'm trying to base it away from tactics in a way. So that's why I said he's a good divisional level kind of general.
I think that's quite fair. Sam, let me get your thoughts on this. Because Ney's very loyal. Well, he's sort of loyal to Napoleon and he's not loyal to Napoleon.
He's loyal to France.
Good point. This is another thing we need to actually talk about, this because the criteria of a lot of the pitches is like loyalty to Napoleon and loyalty to France. You'll see this emerging. So actually keep that in mind, guys.
But I mean, I can't believe, Josh, you haven't been swept up by the passion and the drama that Todd gave. How on earth can you not bow down to that? It was beautiful. By the end of it, a little tear came to my eye. And I was like, yes, that was beautiful. Go Ney. So you are very, very clearly stone-hearted, cold.
Another good point. He had a very tragic death, didn't he? That's exactly. Convenient.
But this is what feeds into the reputation, right?
He was a martyr for Napoleon at the end.
Are you accusing me, Josh, of only liking the ones that die in their prime?
We all love a good tragic hero, is all I'm saying.
I mean, it doesn't hurt anyone's reputation to, inverted commas, do a Nelson or a Wolfe or an Abercrombie or a Moore. I mean, particularly in Moore's case.
I mean, in fairness to the British, none of ours were shot by our own men.
No. Well, how do you know, Josh? Were you there?
Admiral, is it Admiral Byng? Or well, the yes, chap who was shot on his own flagship?
Let's the not last talk one about Byng. let's pretend that little thing doesn't happen because it's not convenient, because history is what we want to make believe. At least if you adhere to the Ridley Scott School anyway. Yeah, integrity is big with Ney, and this is something that quite a few of the people pitching have emphasised. Where their figures have integrity, they do like to make that point, because with the best one in the world, some of these marshals don't. But Ney vacillates a lot, which I struggle with. The whole bringing back, he's there to bring back Napoleon and then doesn't. He sided with Napoleon, then decides to side with the Bourbons. I can understand that, but to then go back to Napoleon having said, no, actually, I'm going to go arrest this guy, that's a problem.
Just can't turn down Napoleon's little face. You get there, you see him, he goes, fight with me, and you're like, yes, my emperor, I will fight with you. It comes to us all, Zach, it will come to you too.
I fervently hope that day never arrives.
It was a poor career choice, has to be said.
It was a poor life choice, like, never mind a poor career choice.
Yeah, I mean, but he's Ney is what I will say is that the Napoleon movie should have probably been the Ney movie. It would have been much better if it had been about Ney, and you actually all had that great kind of, do I go back to Napoleon, do I not go back to Napoleon? You get all the battles, you have literally a rags to riches story. He's a very impressive man. from a cavalry sergeant to Prince de la Moskova. Undeniable, but I'm not sure if he actually, within this group, and this may be surprising given what we're going to be talking about next, I'm not sure if he actually stacks up against the others.
Fighting talk from Josh there. What I will just say is that if they ever do a Ney movie and they don't title it, I am Ney, then they have missed a marketing
movie. No, they just need to call it Marshal of France.
Okay, fair enough. But Josh, you're the one who's saying he's not the greatest marshal. So
he is meat for cinema. Put the writing cap on, you fly with Ney. That's beside the point.
Okay, so the greatest story of the Marshals, maybe, by Josh's, the most Hollywood-esque of the Marshals. No, surely Murat is more Hollywood-esque.
I'd need to read more about him because I presume he has a serious side that is not absurd, but I don't know what that is.
It's a dangerous presumption there, Josh, I must admit. Okay, Sam, anything else you want to say on Ney?
Only that I think the fact that you two see him rejoining Napoleon, having said he'll fight for the Bourbons, is a negative. It's a very interesting example of how different people can interpret different things, because to me, that's a strength. That's one of the things that makes him the best marshal, because yes, he goes back to Napoleon and he does that.
With all respect, though, did you not just credit him for being loyal to France, for betraying Napoleon?
Because he thinks that Napoleon is the best thing for France.
Well, he didn't in 1814.
People change their minds.
The anarchy has descended. We've got another 4.5 episodes of this. How are we going to survive it? Right, let us move on very swiftly. Thank you again to Todd for a cracking pitch that's made us laugh and have a bust up already. And we're only on our second marshal. We now move on to Soul, who is championed by Dan Hazelwood.
Soult is clearly the finest of Napoleon's marshals. If you look at all the diverse talents required to be a great marshal, only Soult has all of them. And not only that, Napoleon will agree with that characterization and say that he is the finest marshal. So the decision is clear. First, personal courage. Soult, like many, did things at great risk for himself. He had three horses shot out from underneath him at around the Battle of Waterloo. No, not in 1815, but in 1794. After Flores, Soult was conducting operations there. He went on. Messina recruited him as Messina's right hand in Italy. Soult was famously wounded badly in the leg, was actually captured by the Austrians, and was recovered in Alexandria during the battle. You could hear the Battle of Marengo in the background. Soult had the personal courage on the battlefield. And in fact, Messina would say he could not praise too highly Soult's bravery and military skill. So there you have it, one of the great other marshals heaping praise on Soult. As a battlefield commander, Soult was in the first rank. His tactical successes during the Revolutionary era, then in the camp of Boulogne, training the troops for Napoleon, being the prime person that Napoleon was working through for the largest corps. His corps was at Austerlitz. Napoleon used it as the center and launched the divisions to capture the great victory. The battles continue. Jena, they play a role. At Heilsberg, Soult again has two horses shot out from him, playing a critical role there. At the Battle of Eylau, Soult's corps is receiving much of the Russian attack. And at the end of the battle, the marshals gather with Napoleon on whether they should stay to fight another day. And Murat says that the enemy cannon is severe and your losses are extreme. And Surgeon Leray writes that Soult stepped forward and said that French bullets were not made of cotton either. And he argued to stay, and Napoleon used Soult's support as an excuse to do what Napoleon wanted, which was to stay and defeat the Russians. If in another day's battle was in the offing, the Russians would withdraw. Spain, Napoleon would send him in. He would relieve Bessier and immediately reverse. The French were being chased from Spain. He would go in, seize Burgos, and suddenly the French were on the offensive again. He was the spearhead. Napoleon would obviously follow in as well in the pursuit of more towards Corona, where Marshal Ney would not cooperate and did not send the troops that Napoleon had told him to do. Interestingly, in preparation for that, Soult would countermand some of Napoleon's orders to troops to have them better positioned for the pursuit. And Napoleon afterwards agreed with Soult's decision. Very few marshals get to countermand Napoleon. Soult did on more than one occasion, and Napoleon agreed with it after the fact. The war goes on. Soult gets sent to Andalusia, governs there. Famously, the author who writes that Marshal Suchet was this great counterinsurgency success in Spain says that he was a co-equal with Soult in counterinsurgency operations. Again, Andalusia was a vibrant, functioning economy with less guerrilla activity than other parts of Spain. He led the armies that destroyed the last Spanish field army at Ocaña, capturing 20,000 prisoners, working closely with Marshal Mortier, a marshal he'd be good friends with. Again, Soult stands out as one of the marshals who got along very well with a large number of the marshals, not all of them. Albuera, he's about to have a great victory, but it's snatched from him. And no less esteemed person than Professor Esdale says Soult absolutely would have won that battle had his two lead column colonels not decided to halt their columns and deploy their troops into line. Without those decisions by colonels, Soult would have had a great victory there. Soult would go on. He would be sent back to guard the Pyrenees and the southern border as Wellington started to push in. Famously, Wellington would complain. He kept trying to destroy the French army, but Soult kept extracting it, even though the best French troops were constantly taken from Soult and sent to Germany. So again, Soult, nobody beats Wellington in the French army, but Soult does okay. Loyalty. One of the preeminent things that's important for a French marshal is loyal to France and to Napoleon. When the Bourbons take power in 1814, he becomes Minister of War. Then when Napoleon comes back for the 100 days, he leaves the service of the Bourbons, Louis XVIII, and goes to work for Napoleon. As Churchill famously said, anybody can rat, but to re-rat takes skill. Churchill did it, and so did Soult. Soult served Napoleon well in the 1815 campaign. In Napoleon's memoirs, when he says that troops complained about officers not to be trusted and they shouldn't trust Soult, Napoleon wrote in his memoirs that he replied, "I can vouch for Marshal Soult as I can for myself." Napoleon trusted him. Marshals, people would constantly say bad things about Soult, but again and again, Napoleon would investigate and say, "I know Soult is loyal to me." But after Napoleon fell in the 1830 revolution, Soult comes back to France. He becomes Minister of War. And then in 1839 to 1847, he becomes President of the National Council, which is Prime Minister. No French marshal has that longevity. The only rival to the longevity and success, Bernadotte, who famously goes to Sweden, leaving the country because they hate him. Soult continues on. Also, Napoleon trusts Soult to be his chief of staff. In 1813, Napoleon first brings Soult, and he's in the spring campaign in Germany, and he's about to be used as a co-chief of staff with Berthier. And it's done because, in the words of General Caulaincourt, who says that alone amongst the marshals, Soult is the most talented and most ready to do this task. Napoleon trusted it. All the people around him said that. Berthier was very difficult, and the Spanish frontier needed Soult sent there. Napoleon trusted loyalty, battlefield competence, courage. There is nothing more outstanding than a marshal than Soult. Clearly the finest of them all, and Napoleon agrees with that assessment.
Dan Hazelwood there, making the case for Soult. Some good points, personal courage, good management, loyalty. We can get into the blind loyalty debate yet again, dare we? I think battlefield competence is big within this. Napoleon agreed that with Dan in the course of that. I think Wellington would probably agree. There's a debate about who comes closer to handing Wellington's arse to him, Massena or Soult. I would say that perhaps Massena wins out, but probably because Wellington is on Wellington at Fuente Don Euro and ballses it up and overextends himself, which is a rare thing for him to do. Sure, Massena capitalizes, but Soult, I feel, manages to make more of the opportunity when it comes to the Pyrenees and does so in arguably less favorable circumstances with an army that is very poor quality and severely lacking in morale. This is the army that's just lost at Vittoria, and yet he somehow manages to sort of bring them back, turn them around and send them back out. He does pretty darn well. So straight fight, yeah, I'm not sure in my head on quite who I think wins out in that fight between Soult and Massena, but I think it's a very compelling case. Another very strong contender in a heap full of exceptionally strong contenders. Just to reassure our listeners, I mentioned earlier on that seven will go through despite there being five heats, so our judges will have the opportunity to discuss wild cards. So two wild cards will be plucked from the remainder who don't make it through, based purely on the judging and popular vote, and then they will also go through to the final seven. So there is an opportunity still for your favorite, so lobby us, because you might be able to swear that. I don't mean like DM us on our private Instagram accounts and things, just no, but make the case, we're listening. So Soult may yet go through if he doesn't win the popular vote, as may Bertier. I've lost the plot already. What do I mean, lost the plot? I never had the plot. To get to the crux of it, though, Dan did make an important point that it's the combination. You might have an individual marshal who wins out on any singular point, you know, a particular moment where they shine that shows tactical brilliance, or, you know, let's say Bertier and his administrative ability or loyalty or truth to power, whatever it might be. But actually Soult perhaps is the one who ranks highest on all factors without necessarily quite edging out the others on any one. Josh, let's get your thoughts, first of all, on Soult.
Anybody who's listened to the Bernese Boys in Spain will know that I ask people to not judge Soult on Spain, or indeed, to some extent, Waterloo, in terms of his tactical ability. A lot of people criticize Napoleon for assigning Soult the job of Bertier, but the fact that he did so suggests actually that he had a very, very high opinion of Soult's organizational ability. The fact that it didn't come through in that campaign is against him, obviously. He's the officer, he's the marshal who has the longest sustained, I think, period of service in Spain against Wellington. He's there at Oporto, and then he's there at the end at Vittoria. And he's thrown in 1813 basically because Napoleon needs a guy who can fix stuff and hold the line. And apparently Soult is the guy he's set to do that. He has a very bad reputation, to, generally speaking, in as regards Ney or some of the other more flamboyant officers. But that's because he spent his service in Spain, most of it. And that's not going to do anybody's reputation any good. I found that the case is quite strong. The argument is a little weaker, possibly because it's Soult and he suffers already from a certain stigma. it's good to remember that he was one of the guys at Austerlitz. He's that legendary bit they didn't include in the movie where Napoleon asks him, how long will it take you to get your men up there? And he looks at his watch and he goes, 12 minutes. Done. Not a big problem. And funnily enough, people seem to only remember him as a sort of a stuffy Bourbon minister of war, because he did become one of the grand old men of the French army. Very long service record, actually. But people forget that in the 1805 era, he was actually kind of flashy. He designed his own staff uniforms and everything. That you could see, they were like canaries running around during the Corona campaign, with Soult's staff. And he thought, I think, he was going to become king of Spain at one point, but his reputation is admittedly mixed. But my biggest sort of consideration in terms of adding to the case already is that Napoleon gave him a lot of independent commands and a lot of high responsibility commands as a marshal, as opposed to Ney, who, though tactically seems stronger at the same time, but didn't necessarily pull off anything better at Quatre Bras, did not get entrusted with the reorganization of armies, the governing of provinces, or high staff positions. So maybe he's above Ney.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it Soult who's controlling Andalusia come 1812? And from what I can recall, is doing quite an effective job of controlling Andalusia up until the point that Napoleon wins at Salamanca, the point at Wellington wins at Salamanca. Wow, that was a slip of the tongue. And then everybody panics and he has to pack up and head north. So there is...
He does very well in 1812 and 1813 when he marches down Wellington's flank during the Burgos campaign, not to make it all about Spain, because again, he was on several staffs and several general de division level appointments in the Revolutionary War as well. It's one of the first batch of marshals. So he'd obviously done good work. Was he on Massena's staff or something like that? I forget precisely, but no, he's absolutely very high tier, even though because of his association with British military history in the Peninsular War, he doesn't get rated very well. And also because of Waterloo is the problem, and whether you're loyal to France or whether you're loyal to Napoleon or...
The Wellington factor is a problem for a few of these guys, not least Marmont. And it does become something of a whipping post for people who want to elevate other marshals, you know, whether it's Suchet. Well, Suchet was never beaten by Wellington. Well, no, because he never faced him. Doesn't mean that Suchet couldn't beat Wellington. It just means he never had the opportunity. Davout is the one that everyone salivates over. What happens if those two end up face to face? Lannes is an interesting one. You know, if you have Lannes at any point in Spain, what happens? That, you know, all of these.
He was in Spain.
Yeah, he
but not
took...
against Wellington.
No, he took Zaragoza the second time.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very decent
there, by my guess.
We'll get to him, so we shouldn't do any spoilers or anything like that. But he's very good at throwing himself over walls, is Lannes.
He likes that. he certainly does. Okay, Sam, let me get your thoughts when it comes to Soult and the strengths of this pitch.
So first of all, I do like the sucking up that was given to Charles Esdelt at the beginning there. Is Charles doing one of the pitches in a later episode?
No.
Okay. I wondered if it was a way to try and if it was a way to placate him if he got beaten by this guy, but never mind. He just didn't really like Charles, so that's nice. That's fine. I think a lot of Josh's arguments there in favour of Soult were very much, but we shouldn't hold the peninsula against him, but we shouldn't hold Waterloo against him. That's a lot of buts. That's a lot of, oh, well, he was great when he was great, and then he wasn't when he wasn't. And that's fair as a marshal, absolutely fair, but not as the best marshal. You can't have that as the greatest marshal is, but ignore that bit, more than 50% of the time.
Prats and Heights doesn't sway you, though? You know, because it's Fourth Corps that take the Pratzen Heights, if I remember rightly, which is Sewell's. Davout has third call that comes in the nick of time. We'll talk about that next time. But, I mean, that's significant, surely.
I mean, Sam makes a good point. I am actually not arguing that he is the greatest. I'm saying he's possibly better than Ney, based on the contemporary usage.
Josh is tearing already. Josh has gone into there's like a god tier. What company is a god tier? Like a Zeus. So you've got a Zeus tier. You've got a Jesus tier, and then
because Sam's right. He messes up royally in 1815. That is bad staff work, and he was better than that. As for Spain, Spain is a mess for the French.
Spain is Murat's fault. I'm going to say that here and now, and we will get into that rant in due course. Folks, anything else you want to say in defense or denigration of Sewell? Nope. Okie doke. Well, our judges will now pause and reconvene in due course do you just want to do this live? Do you want to have this vociferous argument? Let's record it and see what happens in this vociferous argument that I suspect might not actually be that vociferous in the end. So a reminder to our listeners, 5 points to the strongest case, which is kind of a judge's decision fused between both the history and the strength of the cases made. And then we will, of course, hand it over to the public vote for the remainder of the points scoring on this. So, who wins out?
Well, let's both say what our tier is, and then we can argue about
All right then. So Josh is doing a better job of organizing this than I am. Let the record reflect that. I won't even edit that out. So Josh, your ranking, please.
Okay. Well, I will rank it first place to Berthier, second place to Sewell, and third place to Ney.
Sam, your ranking?
It's okay. I will survive this. My first place will shock you. I have painfully put my bias slightly aside, and my top place is Berthier. My second one is Ney. Like, I can't put my biases too far there. And then my third place is Sewell. But it's not the bias is only partly to play, because I still maintain by my argument that the peninsula has to count.
Yes, it's true. The problem I have with that is that accounts for Ney too.
Yeah, but he's our minority candidate with the red hair, so we've got to be quite...
Yes, that's...
You might just have swayed me, because clearly now I have to have the casting vote on this. I would agree with you, Berthier wins out.
And the only other thing I will say is that Ney needs no help.
That is fair. That is actually very fair. Ney doesn't.
As a judge, Ney needs no help.
See, Sam is trying to lead me to the dark side, because I have a reputation for liking people with red hair. so can I find the integrity within myself? Am I actually one of these? We're going full circle here. Am I one of these people who would be swayed back to the Bourbon side and then back to Napoleon in 1815? Have I been living a lie?
Both Sewell and Ney did that.
The quality of the pitch was part of the scoring, and
good quality.
Todd's passion.
Yes.
Todd's passion cannot be beaten.
And I can't sit on the fence and rank them equally either, which is what I would do if this were a seminar group, because that's a nice, easy get out clause.
Sewell's case was stronger than Todd's, though.
Who is the bet? It is Sewell, isn't it? In terms of battlefield record,
Independent command is the thing you have to look at here. Who did Napoleon give the important stuff to?
Yeah,
he said, "Ney, lead that cavalry charge. Sewell, take over Spain."
This is taking more soul searching than I hoped, but I think Josh is right. I think the casting vote is Berthier, Sewell, and then Ney. So that will be our ranking. Berthier gets 5 points. Saul gets 4, and Ney sadly only gets 3, but a very valiantly hard-fought one.
Ney will be fine.
But folks, you can turn this on its head, because the winner of the public vote gets 4 points, second place 3, and then so on down the list. So although the judges have just that slight edge, it is still all to play for, because Ney could romp home to 7 points. And who knows, maybe Berthier, actually the numbers don't work on this, do they?
What?
I'm just doing the maths in my head. There are three content, four, three. No, we, oh dear. This could be a joint tie. Why am I making the listeners aware of this? But I do find it slightly hilarious that I've spent literally about 6 weeks planning this. And it's only just occurred to me that mathematically, if Ney wins the public vote, he gets 4 points. If Berthier loses, he gets 2 points, because there are only three people in this heat, which means that Berthier and Ney tie for first place. Oh, this is a mess.
Well, then we can make an executive call later on.
End up eating up some of our wild cards. I'm hoping that when we have four, this will be less of a problem. This is a flaw in the system. Welcome, folks, to this podcast. You have been listening to the Napoleonic Wars podcast by the imbecile that is Dr. Zach White. Thank you for your attentiveness. Big thank you to Sam Jolly, curator of the Royal Logistic Corps Museum, Worthy Down, Winchester, and Josh Proven, master of the Adventures in Historyland YouTube channel and author of Bullock's Grain and Good Madeira and Every Hazard and Fatigue. Both books that you need to acquire.
I really need to do shorter titles for you in the future.
It would help massively. Can you just bear that in mind, please? Because it takes forever. A big thank you also to those of my guests who, those fans of the show, in fact, who very valiantly contributed to these pictures. The fact that we had this kind of quality of discussion says a lot about the passion and the strength of the cases made. Ed Koss arguing for Berthier, Todd Campbell for Ney, and Dan Hazelwood for Saul. We will be back, folks, very soon. Folks, you know the drill by now. If you're new here, remember to hit that subscribe button so that you can find your way back. And if you're loving the show, remember to leave a review. It makes a vast amount of difference in terms of helping this show to reach a wider audience. Much love to all of my Patreon supporters, who hopefully are going to start enjoying some slightly different elements of the perk package. Shout outs to my mentioned in dispatches patrons, Rob Griffith, Brendan Teeling, Beatrice DeGraff, Lynn Dawson, Lucy Tatner, Jim Deary, Josh Keeney, Colin Fieldhouse, Stephen Coulson, Jim Getz, Stephen Gillen, Hugh Brennan, Alistair Campbell-Grieve, Andy Meakin, Mark Anscombe, Rob Coughlin, Bruins Girl, Noah Fink, Mark Trowbridge, Mars Reedy, Nick Overland, Graham Goodwin, Chris Pramus, Anthony Gumbau, Anonymous American, Martin Pisani, Auric Ducado, James Fluick, Roger O'Donnell, Natasha Hobday, Rod Schwager, Chris Kimball, Gary Dennis, David Graylick, Ted Andrews, David Milinski, Richard Anderson, Arthur Forgy, Sam Moore, Wyatt Pollock, Carol Dixon Smith, Roland Shark, Jason Moran, and Mark Chestnut. And the Admirals, John Haynes, Ryan Diamond, JC Kaiser, Bob Burnham, Mike Guest, Liam Telfer, Todd and Led Campbell, Graham Swidenbank, Rachel Stark, Mark Duckers, David Maxwell, David Priest, Graham Callister, Sean Sullivan, Stephen Ashworth, Dan Hazelwood, Kate Walcombe, Steve Carter, Clemens Bemmon, Charles McKay, Reto the Sci-Fi Fan, and Tim Day. I'll be back very soon, but until then, I'm Zach White. This has been the Napoleonic Wars Pod. Take care of yourselves, my friends. Stay well, stay safe, and as always, thank you for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.